On the Finest podcast, we cover the people, art, and movements redefining culture in San Diego, from Blink 182 to scrappy local bands. We also have cults, a lost composer, a world record traveler, and champion birders. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It's time for KPBS Midday Edition. For today's Arts and Culture show, we're talking about the start of the Padres season, local food, and more. I'm Andrew Bracken, in for Jade Heinemann, with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. Padre fans are ready to hear their two favorite words today, play ball. We get a live report from Petco on Padre's opening day. Then San Diego chef Eric Bost is receiving major accolades. We hear more about his passion and approach to cooking. Plus, midday movies and a preview of the weekend arts events. That's ahead on Midday Edition. In just about an hour from now, the San Diego Padres 2026 season begins. They start the first of a three-game series against the Detroit Tigers down at Petco. And now, the Gaslamp Quarter is being overrun by brown and gold as fans take in all that opening day has to offer, from the food and drinks to the hopes of a World Series championship for San Diego. And KPBS's Jacob Ayer is down at Petco and joins me live now. Jacob, welcome to Midday Edition.
Hey, thank you, Andrew, for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So you've been down at Petco since this morning. Paint the picture for us. What's happening down there?
Yeah, we've been down here since pretty early this morning. And honestly, since about 8 or 9 a.m., there's been fans that have been slowly increasing. And they've been all around the ballpark. You know, they've been getting drinks at nearby restaurants and bars. They've been wearing their different memorabilia, and they've been vocal. They were even waiting outside the gates just trying to get in. They didn't even open the gates until 11 a.m. for fans. So a lot of excitement, and it's filling up pretty rapidly now as we're rapidly approaching game time.
Yeah, I think we can hear some of those fans behind you actually now. So we know opening day is just, you know, I don't know, it's like a day of optimism, right? And you've been talking with fans throughout the morning. So what have they had to say about the Padres and the season ahead?
Yeah, we were able to chat already with about six or maybe eight different fans who have been out here. They were all kind of saying that they're hopeful. They're aware that, you know, not too far up the freeway, the Dodgers are a two-time reigning champ. So
I know.
But they are excited. People are hopeful that there's some new signings on the team. And we actually had a chance to speak with one of them earlier, David Romero, who kind of gave us his rundown about being here for opening day.
It means a lot. Like, I requested work off maybe like 3 days ago, a week ago, and I'm just like excited to be here. This is my fourth year in a row, and I just can't wait to get inside.
Wow. I mean, you just hear the excitement for the season there. And opening day at Petco, it's something of almost like a local holiday for downtown. Mm-hmm. But, you know, aside from the play on the field and the team, what else are you following this opening day?
Yeah, like you had mentioned, you know, a lot of fans out here are excited. They kind of mentioned it was like a playoff atmosphere. But the other stuff outside and inside the ballpark that are outside of the game itself, of course, there's some new additions. Our own Alex Wynn covered this yesterday. You know, there's new screens inside the ballpark. There's some new food offerings. There's even a new cocktail lounge just outside the park. But there's also this addition of the metered parking increases this year. This actually was passed by City Council last fall. And now the meters have gone from $2.50 to $10 an hour during large events in downtown. So we talked with fans about, you know, how they're getting to the game, what they think about this increased charge. And a lot of people were actually aware of it. They said instead of maybe driving down here, trying to pay for that, plus deal with the traffic, a lot of them are opting for transit.
And I imagine the trolley's probably getting a lot of that overflow, right? Jacob, the Padres, so they're taking on the Detroit Tigers. It's, you know, getting close to first pitch here. Tell us more about this matchup, what fans can expect.
Yeah, for today's game, it's going to be Nick Pivetta on the mound for the Padres. And then on the side for Detroit, it's going to be Skubal. He is one of the best pitchers in all of Major League Baseball. It's going to be a three-game series today, tomorrow, and then we have a final game this weekend. And then afterwards, they're going to be taking on the Giants before they go on a road trip.
So, I mean, another, you know, another person you got the chance to chat with a little bit earlier was Padres star Manny Machado. What did he have to say about, you know, I imagine he's more in just business mode, but what did he have to say on the start of the season?
Yeah, he's excited. I mean, he's happy to be, he said he's happy to be back here in San Diego and take on another opening day. He seems very focused. He said he's focused on health in particular for both himself and the team. And he said he's excited about everything that's offered during opening day, whether that's the extra kind of pageantry of it all, to, you know, the loud crowd. We had mentioned it kind of feels like a playoff atmosphere in some ways for fans. So he's excited for everything. Health is definitely his top priority, is what he had relayed to us.
So, you know, you've kind of talked about the fan excitement, you know, just that energy you're feeling down there. And, you know, I'm wondering what fans have had to say about, you know, just what they're hoping to see on the field this season. You mentioned how long of a season it is, but we know the Padres have been pretty used to the playoffs the last few years, right? Mm-hmm. What can fans expect, do you think, from the team this season?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, Andrew, but I think fans, you know, when I was talking to them, they're hopeful that they can make a deep playoff push. A lot of them are hoping that, you know, the team can finally get that World Series we've been looking for. They've really been pushing both financially and then in terms of the standings for, you know, playoff runs over the last 5 or so years. The team's hoping, a lot of the fans of the team are hoping that this is their year. They're aware that the Dodgers are a powerhouse just up north, but one fan told me, you know, they're trying to slay the dragon for good this year and finally bring that ring back home. So fans are hopeful. They're aware of the realities of the other teams in our division, but they're hopeful that the team can make a deep playoff run.
Well, that's great to hear the optimism. We hope it, you know, plays off on the field today. I've been speaking with KPBS reporter Jacob Ayer. He's been joining us live from down at Petco Park. Jacob, thanks so much. Enjoy the game.
Thank you, folks, for having me. Appreciate it.
Now we go from the world of Fryer Franks and popcorn, and now turning to some fine dining here in San Diego. Each year, the James Beard Foundation recognizes culinary excellence, and one of this year's semifinalists in California is Chef Eric Bost. He oversees 2 Michelin-starred restaurants in San Diego, Lilo and June and Julie. Am I pronouncing that right?
You got it.
Okay, it's tough. French is not my first language. He joins me now to talk about this nomination and his own culinary journey. Chef Eric, welcome.
Great. Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
So glad to have you here. So tell me, you know, tell us, you know, about your initial reaction to hearing about becoming named a semifinalist for this award.
Sure. I mean, it's obviously feels amazing to be nominated. There's so many chefs on this list who I personally look up to that our teams look up to. It feels really, you know, comforting to know that this is really the sort of, I don't know, the affirmation that our team does an amazing job. So, of course, it feels really good. There's so many people involved. You mentioned 2 of our restaurants. We have 2 more. We have Wildland and we have Campfire as well. And all of them, we're 250 employees strong at this point. And I think I feel really fortunate to be the person who gets to kind of carry that. But the nomination is really about, like, the hard work of everyone.
Yeah. And then, you know, another sort of award or, you know, recognition you got, your restaurant Lilo, you know, pretty quickly received a Michelin star. Is that right?
What did
that honor mean for that? And it happened so quickly, right? That's pretty unusual.
Yeah, it's unusual. It was 10 weeks in. We know, or, you know, the guide called out some of the dishes from the first week on the menu. So we know they were there very early, which is great. Obviously, restaurants take a long time to build, to put the team together, mm-hmm. to work through the menu, to just have all the components. We spent an enormous amount of time training so that when we did open, we felt really confident that we were executing at a high level, that we were contributing something special, and that we were, you know, the experience we were trying to do was as close to what we had envisioned as possible. So I think it was really important to also, you know, generate awareness. Like for a young restaurant, those early days are super important. We had a lot of baked-in goodwill from the other restaurants, which helped, but it's also just like creates awareness. It creates demand. And again, it does affirm that we're on the right track. We really have the mentality across all the teams that every day is an opportunity to make improvements. And so there's really no resting on laurels. It's like, how do we lean into our strengths? And then we're pretty critical on like where the opportunities we can get better.
So, I mean, both of these restaurants we've been talking about, Lilo and June and Julie, they're both in Carlsbad. Yes. And I want to talk a little bit about Carlsbad specifically and just the San Diego culinary scene. But talk to me, why was Carlsbad the right place for these restaurants?
First, because they didn't exist. So my business partner, John, he opened Campfire hit 10 years this year. So Campfire was one of the first restaurants, really, I think, to create a unique bar program, unique cuisine, and really to like put a footprint in Carlsbad, or what we know as kind of Carlsbad today. After became Jeune et Jolie. And then when I came down from LA and we started partnering on restaurants and figuring out what we wanted to create, really the idea was, what are we excited about? What doesn't currently exist? And what do we think people will really enjoy? So how do we contribute? How do we kind of continue our own voice and do something that felt like from the same group, from the same DNA, but was also like things that we were just jazzed about.
And talk to me about that DNA. I mean, what is that just like from a food perspective? What am I likely to experience?
Sure. I mean, you're going to experience great product. Like part of this is really leaning into San Diego. San Diego is an amazing place to be a chef. It's the highest concentration of small family farms in the U.S. We're like good friends with dozens of farms in this area. And it's really about like taking beautiful product, using that to the best of like what the restaurant's identity is. And we're really trying to make each restaurant the best version of itself. So it's not like each one's not redundant, but you can definitely expect great product. Really thoughtful cooking, technique driven, but ultimately delicious. Like it's not just meant to be, single layered. It's really about like an entire thought process that goes into it. It's consistent. All of the restaurants are super energetic, like great playlist, really good bar programs, really great wine programs. So it's not just the food. And so the things that we're trying to build or that we continue to lean into are design, our food, our beverage, and our like genuine hospitality. So part of the thing, I mean, back to what you were saying about James Beard was really, mm-hmm. to me, felt great for the food. The food is only one aspect, though. I mean, James Beard is very much into social, having a social voice, contributing something to the environment. You mentioned earlier in the last sort of section about community and optimism. We're like focus a lot of time on culture. And so we have these five things that are really the fundamentals, and it's grace, growth, grit, community, and optimism. And so those help drive a culture where our team feels supported, where they feel inspired, where they feel like their time is well spent. And if we can hone in on like, how do we create great systems? How do we create this ecosystem within Carlsbad? It will help us from like to be unique, to contribute something to our community, and whether that's our team or our guest or the farms we're supporting or the fishermen we're supporting. And make sure that like the whole thing just becomes a catalyst for continued evolution.
So you're originally from North Carolina, but you've pretty much worked all over the world. We were talking before about some of the places. Tell us about those and what you took from each of those stops and how it kind of sure. plays into your life now.
Yeah. I mean, growing up in North Carolina, my grandparents were in the restaurant business. So I was a
so
young
you were
teenager.
In it early.
Yeah,
okay.
I was in it. Yeah. I was wrapping baked potatoes in the kitchen. I was bussing tables back with, a pressed white shirt with a cummerbund and a bow tie. And so in the early days, I then went to business school and then went to culinary school after. And at that point was really about like, how do I take this idea of food, this love of food, and how do I make it refine the craft? How do I continue to be inspired and work for the best people I could? So obviously at the time I was like, we got to go to France. So I had met my wife. I was working for a French chef in the Caribbean, met my wife and kind of disappeared or stopped working where I was and joined her in Europe. So 3 years in Europe, Alain Ducasse at Place Athénée. I worked for the Hotel de Crillon, some 2 and 3 Michelin star restaurants where I really wanted to understand large brigade structure, product, just like the savoir-faire of French cooking. It got me on this path of just like continually trying to work around the strongest people. And to your point, take something new from each place that I was. Like how do I keep layering on different skills? So after France, I came back to the U.S. I lived in San Diego, so this was 20 years ago. My wife and I, we crossed the country. And so we spent 6 weeks and San Diego was like the place. We're like, okay, we're definitely going to live here. And so we lived here for about 3 years. I'd missed some big structure at that point. Again, great product, cool things happening, but I missed like France. And so I went, Guy Savoy was opening in Las Vegas, joined his team. So at the time he had 3 Michelin stars for 20 years. Joined that team, spent 4 years there and was like sous chef into chef de cuisine into the executive chef. And then Monsieur started talking about opening in Singapore. And I was like, that's where I want to go. Wow. So went and I was the opening chef in Singapore. And then after about a year and a half, I was the chef and the general manager. And so I just kept taking on more and more responsibility with him. I was back and forth to Paris quite often in the main three-star kitchen. I was we were trying to basically recreate his Parisian experience in Vegas and then in Singapore. And so these 8 years were really instrumental in me developing teams, understanding technique, honing in on like structure. It's like a team sport, like being a good coach, essentially, versus being just a good cook. And so when I left Mr. Savoy, I spent 2 more years back in France, this time in Champagne. I was like, oh, well, I'm an American. There's not too many Americans in France. I should just go and try and like create a Relais Chateau property. I wanted a small 40-seat restaurant. I wanted like 8 rooms. And eventually, I mean, we put a long time into it and ultimately just couldn't make it happen. We had partners. We had a domain. We had like all these things that were working. But what I took out of that was like the vision was clear of what I wanted to do. I had a menu format. I had like an idea of cuisine that I wanted rooted in quality, but also rooted in like vibrancy, aliveness, like herbaceousness, high acidity, ever-changing, like super seasonal. And so that created a conversation anyway with a restaurateur in LA. So from Champagne back to the West Coast into LA, joined Republique and the team with Sprout. And eventually that led into Auburn, which was my first restaurant to open.
So you've just kind of been really all over the world. Obviously, France has played such an important culinary reference point for you, it sounds like. Do you have like a favorite dish? I mean, that's just, you know, from now or 50 years from now, I mean, you're like your go-to?
I love food. It can be very simple or it can be super elaborate as long as it's delicious and tastes good. Probably like the most simple thing is my grandmother's chicken casserole. Is my grandmother on my dad's side. She was a ceramist. She was a potter. But she also had sourdough bread. And so every summer we'd go visit her, and she was always just cooking. It was very simple. It's chicken casserole. But when I look at it now and I look back, she was building chicken velouté. Like she would poach the chicken in broth with tons of aromatics. She'd then pick the chicken. She'd take that broth, and she'd make a roux, and she'd bind the roux. And then she'd combine everything back in with the picked chicken. And at that point, it was like probably Velveeta cheese and you know, crackers on top, which I don't do now. But I do. We still build a velouté. My son,
he still captures that feeling.
Yeah. And my son, he was born in Singapore, and he doesn't like the crust for some reason on chicken casserole. So it's chicken pot rice at this point. It's basically that chicken velouté, vegetables, lots of aromatics, and then rice.
I've been speaking with Chef Eric Bost. He runs multiple restaurants in Carlsbad. So let's go through the list. Lilo, June Jolie, Campfire, and Wildland.
Yeah.
So, you know, congratulations again on this becoming a semifinalist for the James Beard Awards. And the finalists will be announced next Tuesday, March 31st. So
exactly.
Good luck to you there.
Thank you so much
for being here. We really appreciate it.
Appreciate you. Thanks.
Still to come, our midday movies critics highlight the work of some women film directors you should know. You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. Stay tuned. Hi, I'm Andrew Bracken. For the first time in over 50 years, KPBS is now operating without federal funding. That means more than ever, we're powered by you. Your support this year and every year is an investment in local storytelling, trusted journalism, and capturing the moments that bring San Diegans together. Visit kpbs.org/donate to join us. Welcome back. You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Andrew Bracken, in for Jade Hindman. March is Women's History Month, and our midday movies critics are highlighting women directors, both the trailblazers and the emerging new voices in this month's edition of Midday Movies. Jade Hyman spoke with them earlier this week, and here's that conversation.
A new study by the USC Annenberg Inclusion Initiative found that only 9 women directed the top 100 grossing films of last year. So in total, women represent less than 10% of the biggest filmmakers in Hollywood today, and that's a drop from last year. There's still been some recognition, though. This year, Chloe Zhao joined an elite filmmaker group as only the second woman nominated twice for the Best Director Oscar. She directed Hamnet, which got a lot of buzz. So while women are making progress in the film industry, there is still a long, long way to go. Once again, I want to welcome our film critics, KPBS cinema junkie Beth Accomando and Movie Wallace's podcaster Yazdi Bhatavla. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's begin by highlighting women who were pioneers. We're talking directors who really blazed a trail and opened doors for those who followed. Beth, you wanted to remind us of who some of those trailblazers were.
Yes, as the oldest member here, I'm going to go back in history and give you some names. So Alice Guy Blanchet is a French woman credited as the first woman director. And Dorothy Arnaz is the first woman who joined the Directors Guild back in 1936. And her career spanned from the silent era on into the 1940s. But the person I want to highlight is Ida Lupino. Most people probably know her as an actress. She was famous for her tough noir dames in films like Roadhouse and They Drive by Night. But she had this opportunity in 1949. She had scripted a film called Not Wanted, and it was about abortion, which was a daring subject at that time. And the director had a heart attack on the third day of the shoot. And since she knew the script so well, they decided they would let her, uncredited, direct the film. So she stepped in, and she is someone who, while she was making all her films as an actress, was very observant of the director she was working with. So she did a good job. The film made a lot of money, and she ended up forming a film production company with her then-husband, Collier Young, and she directed this great film noir called The Hitchhiker. And as the title implies, it's a story about two men who are driving to a camping trip who end up picking up a hitchhiker with some unpleasant results.
Face front. And keep driving. Sure, I'm Emmett Myers. Do what I tell you. And don't make no fast moves, or a lot of dead heroes back there get nervous.
So this is a gritty, tough-as-they-get noir thriller. There are 3 male leads in this film, no women of note. And I just love how masterfully she handled this film, building tension. She became a very prolific director. She tackled issues of rape and disability in her independently produced features. And she had a really long career directing television. She did over 100 episodes, all genres, westerns, sci-fi, detective. But most notable, she was the only woman to direct an episode of the original Twilight Zone series, and that episode was The Masks. So I just think she is a fantastic trailblazer for us to remember and to seek out her work, both as an actress and as a director.
Yeah, she really opened some doors. And Yazdi, you have another trailblazer to highlight. Who is she?
So I want to highlight Agnès Varda. Agnès Varda was the only female filmmaker who was part of the French New Wave. She directed her first film in 1955 when she was just 27 years old, and she continued on for another 6 decades, all the way to 2019, when she made a documentary about herself and her films called Varda on Agnès, before she passed at the ripe old age of 90. She was known primarily for bringing documentary realism even to her fictional stories. No other than Scorsese has called her one of the gods of cinema. You may know her from very seminal French films such as Cleo from 5 to 7, Gleaners and I, and she made some really wonderful documentaries including Daguerreotypes and my personal favorite, Faces, Places. And to give an idea of the person that she was, here's a clip from an interview with Varda.
And every single film, every single story is a puzzle. You bring the pieces. Does it make an image at the end that makes sense? Does it end with a face or a landscape or a black wall, you know. And what I love the most and what I feel the most now being old, that some pieces of the puzzle are missing, and they will be missing all the time. And there is no one documentary that has all the pieces of the puzzle. It's just some pieces. And you have to invent, to understand, to imagine the rest. There is no truth, you know that.
She did a lot of great work. Well, let's turn to some of your personal favorites. Yazdi, I know you love them all. but if you had to pick just one, who would it be?
There are so many to pick from. I wanted to mention Mira Nair. I wanted to mention Jane Campion. I wanted to mention Catherine Bigelow. But the one I settled on is Gina Prince-Bythewood. She's made lovely movies, including Love and Basketball, The Secret Lives of Bees, Beyond the Lights, as well as The Woman King, most recently with Viola Davis. She has been quietly making studio-backed films since the early 2000s when she first directed Love and Basketball. And is there a better American romantic film made than Love and Basketball? Here's a clip from the movie.
You asked me what was missing.
What?
From basketball.
You woke me up to tell me that?
It's not fun for me anymore because you're missing. What I'm trying to say is, I've loved you since I was 11.
We haven't talked since college. You wait 2 weeks before my wedding to tell me something like that.
I know, I probably should have said it 2 weeks ago.
Beth, who are your favorites?
It's a tough call to narrow that down as well. I will do a little quick mention of Lynn Ramsey. Mm-hmm. She did Ratcatcher, Morven Caller, and really impressively, We Need to Talk About Kevin. What's interesting, her and my other favorite director I'm going to mention, which is Catherine Bigelow, they're both very visual storytellers, but visual in very different ways. Lynn Ramsey is much more kind of this quiet poetry, and Catherine Bigelow is very much into this action, adrenaline-driven kind of filmmaking. I loved Catherine Bigelow from her first film. She did Loveless and then impressively Near Dark, which combines vampires and action, which I absolutely adore. She also did Zero Dark 30, Point Break, which is another great action film. Most recently, she did House of Dynamite. I love the fact that she was a filmmaker that didn't play up being a woman director. She just went out and did these films, took the projects that she loved and that she wanted to do. And, you know, when she was starting out in the late 80s and early 90s, making films like that always meant that she ended up being asked questions like, well, that's a very masculine film. How was it directing it? And, you know, she had to field those questions up until winning for The Hurt Locker. But here's an early interview after she had done Near Dark where she is asked one of those questions about doing an action film.
I don't know. It's sort of hard for me to stand outside it and to see what changes perhaps that film might be able to make. I certainly hope it opens up the arena for women to enter action. Previously, you know, the association of women with sort of more emotional material and men with the apparatus, hardware, technique maybe is breaking down, and within a few years' time it'll no longer be an issue, you know, who directed what, and it'll be, you know, people will be hired based on their strengths and their focus and their inclination. I hope that's the case soon.
Not quite there yet, but definitely making progress. She was briefly married to James Cameron, and I love the fact that she beat him out for Best Director. He was up for Avatar, and she was up and won for The Hurt Locker. So she's someone I've always admired, and I really appreciate the fact that she is a woman director who has refused to be put in a box of what Hollywood and male directors think a woman director should be doing. And she's made no fuss about it at all. She just broke that glass ceiling.
I love that. Well, are there any new female directors you're following?
Yes. So I really love Nia DaCosta. She works in my favorite genre, horror. She is a Black woman who did a fabulous Candyman remake. And then she also did the latest installment of the 28 Years Later franchise, The Bone Temple, which is by far the best of that series since the original. But I do also want to give a shout out to Coralie Farja, who did Revenge and the deliciously gross body horror film, The Substance. So one of the things I like about her is just her attitude towards making films and this kind of bold desire to be provocative. So here she discusses a scene in which Dennis Quaid was eating shrimp with a lot of gusto and disgusting sounds, and this was in The Substance. And here's her response to the request she had to cut that scene out, and this is why I love her work.
Old guys telling me, oh no, but the shrimps, it's too much. Please tone down the shrimps. And I was like, the power of the shrimps, like, you know, like to make them feel so unwell. And I learned on my first feature that when there is a scene that makes everyone uncomfortable and that everyone asks you to cut or to do differently, it's most of the time because there is something very powerful in that scene that you have to stick to.
I agree. I would agree with that. Well, Yazdi, who of this next generation of women directors do you like?
Again, there is so many to pick from, but I wanted to shed light on two relatively new Indian film directors, Payal Kapadia, who made All the Imaginers Light, as well as Shruti Talati, who made Girls Will Be Girls. Both are female filmmakers who are fearless and unafraid to take on pretty charged and provocative material. Both filmmakers also have a way of dealing with female desire with so much honesty and frankness, which has frankly been missing from Indian cinema. Talati made this lovely film called Girls Will Be Girls, and that film is set in a boarding school in India, where a girl begins to assert her burgeoning sexual desire under the watchful gaze of her single-parent mom. And here is a scene from the film where she brings in a co-student who she really likes to meet her mom for the first time.
Hi, Andy. I'm Shree.
Hi, I'm Meera's mom, Anila.
I saw these flowers and thought they were really pretty.
Oh, thanks. Mole, put this in a vase. Come sit. Bring some water also.
Okay.
I didn't know you have such an amazing garden.
Oh, it's my mom's. This house is my mom's only.
Meera was saying that you split your time between here and Haridwar.
I always come for her exams. But this year is very important, no? So I'll be here until her board exams. My daughter's my priority, whether she realizes it or not.
All right, so let's go out with a recommendation for what to look for coming to a cinema. Beth, you've got one that opens today.
Yes, I'm really excited that this is opening today. The film screened at Cannes last year. This is Julia Ducournau's Alpha, but it's only opening here in the U.S. right now. So you can see it in a cinema, which I highly recommend. So both her and Farge have this love of body horror, and they have this fearlessness and this eagerness to provoke. And I love that quality in these films. They are not making films that want to be quiet or passive or ingratiating. So here she discusses her first film, Titan, and how she wanted to hold the audience's interest in her main character, Alexia. She knew that this character was not likable, not sympathetic, and was downright violent at times. And so this is her discussion of how she wanted to deal with both the violence and her character in the opening.
At this level, I think the first thing that I started understanding in her is her anger, her rage, and hence her violence. Because Alexia is a very, like, direct response to the idea that a woman is a designated victim. And I thought, it's funny because a guy who is going to assault someone, or even heckle or whatever, it's never going to occur to that person that that woman could retaliate in a way that could hurt him, actually. And this infuriates me to a point that I actually wanted to bring all that anger in someone who would be, like, able to retaliate just a moment because she is a psychopath. And it means that she doesn't feel fear.
So I love her attitude about women characters. I'm not interested in these role model kinds of women. I want complex, sometimes unlikable, unsympathetic women, but I want them to have depth and dimensionality, and her characters have that. And I also love the way she depicts violence in her films. I think it's very visceral and impactful, which is how it should be. So her new film, Alpha, is about sort of the unexpected consequences of a 13-year-old girl getting a tattoo. And it's sort of an allegory about AIDS, but also about generational trauma. And yes, body horror does come into play.
Very interesting. Well, Yazdi, what's your pick?
So I'm really excited for two movies which are going to be coming out this year. One is the latest from director Olivia Wilde. It's called The Invite. But the one I'm even more interested to watch is the film Josephine, which is directed by Beth De Arujo. And this film was the winner of the Audience and the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance this year. It's going to be released later this year, and it has been clearing up prizes at all the film festivals. And the movie stars Channing Tatum and Gemma Chan as parents of an 8-year-old little girl who is dealing with the trauma of having witnessed a brutal crime. And by all means, I've heard this movie is wonderfully directed and also a joy visually to look at. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Wow. Well, there were so many trailblazers and up-and-coming talent talked about. I've been speaking with KPBS arts reporter Beth Accomando and Movie Wallace's podcaster Yazdi Batavla. For more on their picks, check out kpbs.org. Beth, Yazdi, as always, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, we bring you a music-focused weekend arts preview. You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. Stay tuned.
There can be a lot to worry about when selling a car, but not when you donate it to Distinction. Donate your old car, truck, or RV to help pay for the programs you enjoy and rely on. Here's how.
Call 877-KPBS-CAR.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Andrew Bracken, in for Jade Heinemann. For our weekend arts preview, we're taking a closer look at some diverse music options in town this weekend, from the drag performer Flamey Grant to a piano superstar, even a kid-friendly symphony. Joining me with all the details is KPBS arts reporter and host of The Finest podcast, Julia Dixon Evans. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Great to see you. So let's ease into things here with some piano. What can we expect from Lang Lang?
So, yeah, this is tonight. It's at Jacobs Music Center downtown, but it is presented by La Jolla Music Society. And Lang Lang is basically a piano superstar. Like, he's played for more world leaders than I can count. He has such a dynamic stage energy, but also just, like, really skilled, really expressive. In this concert, he'll perform, like, pretty broad range of composers. There's Mozart, Beethoven, Liszt, but also lesser-known composers. There's Enrique Granados, Isaac Albanese. This is Suite Española by Albanese, recorded by Lang Lang. And the concert's tonight at 7:30, and there are still some tickets available.
Great. So next up is this thing, Songwriter Sanctuary. What do you know about this project?
Yeah, so Songwriter Sanctuary, it's this really intimate performance showcase. It's now in its third year. They bring together a few performers to the sanctuary space at Normal Heights United Church, and it's hosted by Jeff Berkeley, who's this longtime local folk star. And this month's show is pretty special because it's all former members of Baby Bushka, the Kate Bush tribute project. They played their final show in 2024. So we have Marie Haddad, Nancy Ross, Heather Nation. Nancy was one of the founding members of Baby Bushka, and then Marie and Heather both joined the crew at various points in his history. And they'll all be performing original solo music. We're listening to Heather Nation's song Woman, which was recorded in 2024. It's a really strong track. And Songwriter Sanctuary, it's Friday night in Normal Heights, and they have a suggested donation of $10 to see it.
Also, Friday night, we have the drag queen who once topped the Christian music charts on iTunes. Tell us about Flamie Grant.
Yeah, so Flamie Grant has local ties. She had a residency at a local church, and they once started a church here as well. Flamie Grant's non-drag identity is Matthew Lovegood. And I learned about Flamie Grant from Katie Heisen, one of our reporters here, did a story a couple years ago. Matthew was raised in a conservative, fundamentalist church, and after leaving the church and coming out, kind of forged their own path in religion. Of course, Flamie Grant is inspired by 80s and 90s Christian pop icon, Amy Grant. Lord, Mama tried to keep a little boy clean. She found him with her high heels on a two-foot train of green chiffon. That messy lip was overdrawn. It was a shocking end of scene. Mama knows that she's been This is What Did You Drag Me Into by Bible Belt Baby. That was that album that topped the Christian music charts in 2023. And Flamie Grant will be in San Diego for one show Friday night at Soda Bar tonight with Stucky Lee.
We also have a Festival of the Arts in Oceanside with whole bunch of local music. Mm-hmm. What do you know about Pour Out the Arts?
Yeah, this is at Poor House. It's in Oceanside, and they're hosting this all-ages, all-day festival. They have a vendor fair on the patio with artists and creatives, and then at the center of this festival are performances by five local women singer-songwriters or bands. It's Sasha and the Saws, Ghost Scarlet, Girls Got Nerve, M. Cable Band, and Alice Aylin. This is Alice Aylin's track, Bones. It's from her recent EP, Dear Moon. It just came out last summer. She writes kind of like dreamy folk pop, and the EP has this like great mix of intimate solo guitar and voice songs, as well as some that pack a little bit more of a punch. And the showcase runs from 12 to 8 p.m., so stopping anytime is free.
Totally free.
And, yeah, and Poor House is a really great option for live local music. They make space for a lot of bands and shows. And I'll do one more show plug.
Because
Alice Aylin is also playing a free show at Folk Arts Rare Records in City Heights on Saturday at 3 p.m., along with three other bands. So if you haven't been to Folk Arts yet, or if you want to check out Alice Aylin, but you're not in North County, we got you covered.
Finally, there's one for the kids. Tell us about the Symphony Meet the Strings concerts.
Yeah, so San Diego Symphony, they have this series of family concerts that kind of ease young audiences into classical music. And they're usually a mix of storytelling, like with narration, along with pieces of music that are pretty playful, or they like spotlight an instrument in a way that's really accessible. There's often animals involved. Like this installment, it's called Meet the Strings, Ferdinand the Bull. So these are all songs that show off the string instruments and centered around the story of Ferdinand the Bull. And they'll perform the famous Bizet piece, but also contemporary composers and Henry Mancini's delightful Baby Elephant Walk. And there's often like songs that are super recognizable or like stuff you've heard before. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I love that. There's two concerts on Saturday, 10 a.m. and 11:30. So you can pick the one that works best for your nap time. Tickets are $24, but just to know that everybody needs a ticket, even lap children and babies.
Got it. Well, those are some great options. You can find all the details, these events and a lot more on our website at kpbs.org. I've been speaking with KPBS arts reporter and host of the finest podcast, Julia Dixon Evans. Julia, thanks so much.
Thank you, Andrew. This was fun.
That's our show for today. I'm Andrew Bracken. KPBS Midday Edition airs on KPBS FM weekdays at noon, again at 8 p.m. You can find past episodes at kpbs.org or wherever you listen. Thanks again for listening. Have a great day.
San Diego County is known for being one of America's most expensive regions. KPBS's new series, Price of San Diego, explores the real cost of living, from rising grocery prices to car insurance premiums. Follow our series at kpbs.org/priceofsandiego.